I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympic medalist, and welcome to the EIS Insider, the podcast from the English Institute of Sport. If you don't already know about the EIS, it's been on the front line of elite sport for over two decades, helping athletes and teams bring home the medals. Over the course of this series, we've been lifting the lid on the science behind peak performance and sharing some of its secrets along the way, such as how to eat like an athlete, how to think like an athlete, and even how to view disappointment like an athlete. But today's podcast is all about performing like an athlete, and a huge part of any sport comes down to numbers. How fast, how high, how far, or how strong you are can often be the difference between winning and losing. And it's the analysis of that data that can be the key to unlocking your potential. But can sport really be reduced to just numbers? And what can we deduce from that data? Helping me crunch the numbers in this episode, I'm joined by not one, not two, but three data analysis experts from the EIS. Perhaps three is the magic number for a great podcast, who knows? Firstly, I want to speak to you, Matt Rogan. You're a bit of a sports data guru, if you don't mind me saying. The agency you co-founded, Two Circles, was a pioneer of using data in the sports marketing and events world. And now you're bringing your expertise into data to the sports performance world as a non-exec director of the EIS. So let's start with you. What is data and how does it impact us?
Well, hi there. Thanks for inviting me. I'm secretly quite disappointed I didn't get invited on to the Eat Like an Athlete session, but I'll talk about data instead. So look, as you say, my background is in the data side, but in the, I guess, the commercial side of sports. So what happens off the pitch and data, I guess when we started the business, what we used to say at the time was, look, think about Lego blocks. So if you have a piece of data in isolation, it's just like one Lego block and not really that interesting. And if you get it wrong, it can kind of hurt if you tread on it. But actually, when you start putting different bits of Lego blocks together, you can do some quite cool stuff and you can tell some quite nice stories and be creative with it. And that's effectively how we use data in the commercial space, and Two Circles continues to use data to this day. So it might be interesting to know, Goldie, that you played a game for an under-11s cricket team last week, but in isolation, that's not that useful. But it's useful if we understand where you live, whether it's your first game or your 24th game in the season. Using data to tell stories or build Lego models, and some of the progress that the English Institute of Sport has made over the last few years as well in exactly the same side of things, but doing it on the pitch or on the track or in the pool.
And do you think data in sport has become more prevalent recently? I'm thinking when you're watching a football game, you can see perhaps a heat map of a midfield player, and sports fans are becoming quite used to seeing data game by game and have become quite hooked on it in a way. Are we more aware of data these days?
That's definitely true in terms of its usage in media, to tell stories in media, to help people see or understand a little bit more what's really going on. And ultimately, it helps it create a more compelling spectacle as well for people. You know, if I can understand a little bit some of the science behind what's going on the field of play, then I maybe understand a little bit more, rather than, to use a football analogy, you know, just looking at 22 coloured dots wandering around on a bit of green, I actually understand what's really going on. And actually, from a performance data perspective, you know, it's been used a lot over the course of the last probably decade or so. It's really matured in terms of its usage, but public awareness of that has only happened really quite recently.
Yeah, sure. And it's fair to say that the EIS has worked with data for a while now. So I'll bring in David Gallimore as head of performance data. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you do within the EIS?
Sure. Hi, Goldie. Thanks for having me on. I have the privilege of leading the performance data team within the English Institute of Sport. And we're all about supporting sports and supporting athletes to achieve the amazing performances they do. And, you know, as Matt's just touched on, data is a huge part of sport, and it's in every aspect of the support that the EIS provides and the way sports operate. That's both in their performances, but also in their preparation. And so the performance data team at the EIS exists to really help sports to make a step change in the way they're using the data by providing expertise in data and delivering projects. The people who are supporting the athletes day in, day out.
Great. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of those exciting projects later on. But so we've now got the data, and now I want to bring in alongside David, we've got Julia Wells, who is head of performance analysis at the EIS. So you've now got the data. Now we're analysing that data. What actually is performance analysis, Julia?
Thanks, Goldie. And hi, everyone. Performance analysis predominantly revolves around the analysis of competition and drawing out objective information that can help inform how an athlete or team performs. This takes different approaches into the lead up into a competition. It can take a different approach during competition where we can really impact decision making that can really support, you know, making a final, getting onto that podium. And then obviously post-competition, reviewing performance. So this could be through, for example, video analysis. It could be through the technologies, wearables, tracking devices that's so popular out there now that's producing so much data that we absolutely need support from data experts and make sure that we're, you know, using current and appropriate techniques and technologies to help us maximize that, you know, under pressure when we're in a competition. And we also, you know, which is even more important, wrap that around with athlete and coach insight. So the combination of all of that gives a lot of data. So we have to really try and work together with the coach and the athlete to ensure we're drawing out the really important bits that are going to make the difference. So take a combat sport, for example. They need to understand how they tactically are going to perform and prepare against their opposition on a given day. So understanding themselves and their opposition is key to being best prepared. Reviewing their performances can then inform training, and so the cycle continues.
So what sorts of things are you measuring there? Say in taekwondo with that athlete, what sorts of performance data are you actually analysing on the ground?
Well, if we look at it from a combat sport in general, I mean, there's huge amounts of information that will inform their tactical information. So we will use video to draw out some of the events and key instances that will, you know, support the athlete to understand their strengths and their weaknesses. What tactics are they going to employ during that fight to ensure that they can get the maximum points and stay ahead and then obviously ultimately win that performance? So in a competition, you may be limited on what an athlete can wear, you know, technology-wise, and what you can get from that competition. So for us, video is key. So if you talk to a lot of combat sports, they will say that video is an integral part. If we can get the performance in video format, you know, we can use the coach insight to pull out some of the tactical expertise that can help draw up that plan. We can use tracking devices then in training, and now with the sort of computer science techniques that can help support the computer vision that can draw out some of the information we weren't able to get before, you know, technology advancing all the time. So we're able to look at more movement patterns more objectively and really understand what it takes to be in the ring, be on the mat in those respective sports.
In terms of athletes, as a former javelin thrower myself, I found data super helpful, certainly to confirm that perhaps a technical change was working, to see if something I was working on was actually improving my performance, for example, in biomechanics, measuring speed of release, height of release, etc. And I also looked at data a lot across major championships and Olympics, world championships, to see what you actually needed to perform or what you needed to throw to make a final and then to hopefully win a medal. But also I'd number crunch data around the training that I'd done. So number of throws taken, number of medicine balls thrown and weights lifted and sprints done, etc. And for me, it was all about objective data because numbers don't lie, whereas we are all human beings and we all get quite emotional. And I think you can be lulled into a false sense of security in sport in terms of how you might be performing. So, Julia, is that your experience of working with athletes, that we're all secret sort of number geeks and are obsessed with numbers and our performance, or do you see things slightly differently?
I mean, it varies. It really does vary on the individual. Predominantly, as a practitioner, I worked with canoe slalom. You know, one of our athletes applied to be an astronaut. You know, these guys and girls are intelligent, and they want to see. Of course, they want to see their numbers. Some will want to see it through stories, through video. So it's about. I suppose that's where the art of coaching comes into it, and the the analysts that are embedded in the sports day in, day out, in the environment with the coach and the athlete, are really understanding and exploring how do we get this right, you know, which we know we certainly won't all the time. So it's really important that we tailor that to the individual. And of course, numbers don't lie. Well, I'll question that. Do they lie? You know, sometimes they could. Sometimes they don't tell you the whole story. So you have to, you know, bring in so many different contexts. And that's what I loved about being a practitioner, was being on the front line, you know, in the moment with the athlete and the coach, and really drawing on that intelligence that you know, that actually my numbers can be really poor sometimes and actually not help the individual. So we are one part of a multidisciplinary team, you know, so working with the psychologist to ensure that we're landing it well, you know, working with the coach to ensure that we're putting it in the right sessions in the right time. And also the athlete can have that opinion. When is it best to use information? When is it best not to? Can we give information when they're sitting on the start line, you know, just about to go? Well, we have to have those conversations. And you know, you're making me think of all the memories now of being on the front line on the side of the riverbank. And I'm pretty sure Goldie did a few sessions with you in your training with video. So, you know, yeah, you can see that, you know, that emotional kind of drawing training when they're under pressure and they're really trying to amend something. But we have to take the person into account without a doubt.
And Matt, you're looking quite excited there about the art and the science behind it.
Well, you put that beautifully. That's exactly it. I mean, there's a temptation to think that a performance data team or a performance data strategy would involve a lot of pointy-headed people that you wouldn't let out in daytime, churning numbers ad infinitum. But actually, you know, it's the ability to tell stories, to use Julia's language, about what you've learned in the right way for the right athlete at the right time in the right format that separates some of the fantastically talented people at the English Institute of Sport from other walks of life working with data and indeed some other sporting environments. What we're looking for is people have the emotional intelligence to be able to quickly synthesize the conversation and tell that story in an elegant way, whether to performance director or coach or ultimately directly to the athlete.
So, David, is it possible for certain sports people and coaches to perhaps get a bit too obsessed with the numbers? And we've talked a lot around the fact that there is a human element, obviously, in sport, and there is an art to the sport as well as the science. How do you combat people getting a bit too obsessed with this level of data?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, as with most things, balance is the right answer. I mean, the centre of all of this is a human. You know, this is all about human performance. Humans are so incredibly complex to whittle that down to certain numbers that show everything that happened is simply not possible. So, I mean, the way I see it is you're adding experience, you're adding, for example, from coaches who might have been working with those athletes for years, you're adding experience in terms of, and expertise in terms of sports science and sports medicine. And I think data, it's adding to those conversations. You've got more things that are informing those great conversations between all of those people who are supporting an athlete. And the more information you've got there, in theory, that you know, you're more informed, you can make better decisions about the next step. You know, whether that's what's the recovery plan from this injury, to what's the training session look like tomorrow, do we have a rest day? It's adding another string to the bow. So absolutely, it's about the balance. But I think there's still a huge amount of potential that we're still not yet achieving with what data can tell us and the amount of insight we can get from it. And a lot of the time we're talking about specific data sets in isolation. And what about when Matt said, one piece of Lego doesn't make a whole model? And the more we can join those things together, both the expertise and the data that we have, the more rich that insight is.
And I did hear a cracking story from Tokyo around data, a bit like in the film Moneyball, based on the attempts of the general manager of the Oakland Athletic baseball team, Billy Beane, to assemble a competitive team. Whilst you might not want to blow your own trumpets, I heard that the British swimming team used some data analysis to select their medal-winning mixed relay team using some of your data. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the mixed medley relay. Well, first of all, what a brilliant event. So yeah, it's 4x100 meters swims, I think, with the 4 main strokes. I think this is the first time it was in the Olympics. So, you know, that produces a problem or a performance question. It's like, what's the optimum mix of people in what order to beat a competition which could change, and they might also change their order, you know? So I think part of the reason it was so exciting is because the team winning in the first length by a mile doesn't necessarily win the whole thing overall. So it's all changing. Extremely tactical. But one of the ways you can inform those conversations about what's the right selection, what's the right order, etc., is to look at the data and look at the times of the different people, look at the way in which you order those and how they might compare to competitors who you also have the performance times of, and, you know, throw all those different scenarios in the mix through data analysis to say which one, you know, what's the optimum combination here to achieve the best performance we can on the day. And I know that those kind of discussions were had in swimming, and along with all the other experience and expertise that goes into those conversations. And yeah, I'm very pleased to see the gold medal result in Tokyo.
So Matt, you work a lot with sports organisations. So how do you apply data to a whole organisation that's obviously full of human beings and people, not numbers necessarily?
Carefully, I guess, is the short answer to that. Before you start analysing anything, you spend time with the people you're trying to help, understanding what questions they want to answer, what they think that some of the barriers doing the analysis might be, really vesting them in the importance of the project and helping them feel a part of it. And if you can do that at the front end, and then ultimately help them, a little bit like David just explained with swimming, really help them own the decision making, own the outputs, then you've done your job. You know, I've not found an organization where the data scientists are really the kingpins. The data scientists, the enablers of great decision-making with the people you're working with. And so to that extent, it's just helping people feel comfortable. You're there to support and challenge, but you're not there to take away their decision-making or dehumanize their decision-making.
So could in a department, for instance, marketing, obviously data can be hugely used in that area. Does it replace free will or decision making, or does it just bolster what people might already want to experiment with? How would that work in that setting?
It doesn't replace decision making at all, but it might challenge it. To give you an example, a lot of us who work in sport, whether we're in the commercial side of sport or on the performance side, we love it, and it's been a large part of our lives. And that can be a real challenge when you're trying to design something from the ground up for new audiences or people maybe who don't love the sport yet. So if you look at something like the 100, with a real focus on finding new audiences, data was fundamental in that, because there are very few people in the England Wales Cricket Board who can honestly say they're not fans of the game and don't love the game as currently constructed. And so they're probably going to need external views and the views of other people and the data from other people who aren't yet fans to understand how to create something that's going to work for them. And so the long and short of it is really that in any environment, healthy use of data will challenge and support the thinking that you're doing, but it will never rule it. And you could have done all the data and analytics work you like on something like the 100, but you still needed that sort of right brain intelligence to understand how kids think, understand what it's going to take to get three guys, stereotypically guys, out for a beer to turn up and watch the women's game that they'd never seen before, as well as the men's game that was on afterwards. You know, and that comes down to a lot of the quantitative and qualitative kind of right brain thinking that you can never take out of this kind of project.
Yeah, that's great. And Julia, we have talked about numbers possibly being a bit impersonal, but if we were to take an example in sport, for let's say Dean Rashesmith and Adam Jamili both running the 200 meters, for example, can you use data to highlight their similarities and also most importantly their differences in order to try and organize training that bit better or help inform their training program to make them perform even better at their next championships?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert in athletics, Jill. You'll know more than me, but absolutely, like, they will want to use specific data and parameters that will allow them to assess, you know, from training sessions into competition and then learn from that competition and review those numbers. And I'd like to think review it in combination with the video and the story and the messages that they've learnt. And I'd like to think that then there's other people wrapped around that with regards to their physical prep, you know, psychosocial elements that would then really kind of paint a picture of a whole athlete, so that, you know, your Dina, your Adam truly get a representative of themselves and focus on that as opposed to chasing other people. I guess their start line is all about them and trying to ignore the rest.
And there's been a huge rise in wearable technology. So some of the technologies that you guys have been using for years and years now, I'm sitting here with a kind of Apple Watch on my wrist, something I thought I'd never do. And, you know, everybody at the local park run seems to be hooked up to Strava and all these other sort of technological apps and tracking devices. Can performance analysis now be for everyone? And how much should we be using it in our local park run? Can we be a bit too reliant on this kind of technology?
Absolutely. I think, well, as a keen runner, I'm on Strava all the time as well. We're injured at the moment, so we need to get that sorted. But I think for me, primarily, if I'm honest, it's been about motivation with that stuff. You know, it's been about, I'm motivated by tracking my performance, seeing my progress, beating records, etc. It's a real high motivator. But then, you know, I do look at my sessions are based on heart rate. So I'll go out with a heart rate objective in mind. And the technology now, very low cost, zero effort technology. I don't even have to sync it to my phone. It happens automatically and tells me. It tells me when I'm going too fast and too slow based on what I'm trying to achieve. I have to put zero effort in to get the kind of support around managing your heart rate and all the rest of it that probably wasn't as prevalent before this technology was available.
I do actually now want you all to look to the future. I want to ask you all a kind of million-dollar question. It might be something that you're all working on already and you don't feel free not to give any nuggets away. But if you could invent one bit of kit or piece of technology or data analysis tool that you could measure anything in sport that you think would aid sporting performance, what would it be? I'll start with you, David. Sorry, I didn't give you much time to think there.
Yeah, I think the whole subjective, qualitative side of things for me is the big area. So the thoughts, opinions, like how do you capture in a way that's kind of analyzable, you know, so structured, etc., all these unstructured opinions, experience and thoughts that are built up from maybe 30 years as a coach or all of an athlete's experiences. There's probably the most insight in that. How do we capture it in such a way that allows us to get to that insight when we bring it all together with everything else?
Interesting. And what about you, Matt? What do you see the future of technology? What would you like to invent if you could invent anything?
I've always played ball sports all my life. And I think some of the most interesting stuff going on at the moment is around chips in balls. So, for example, the Caribbean Premier League cricket is trialing a chip in a ball which measures spin and pace and trajectory and power output out of the hand and that kind of stuff. And I just think that's fascinating. And might point to what the future holds in our space, where innovation isn't only happening within organizations like ours, but we're also reacting to some of the innovations that the competitions themselves are developing. So that's on the one side. In terms of what I'd like to invent, something around stress or pressure response in individual humans. You could track over time how athletes are responding to perceptions of stress and pressure, and hopefully then have an objective measure for how a sports psych support is helping.
Interesting. Yeah. So real-time measurement of performance under pressure and adrenaline and how people use that level of excitement stroke pressure. Yep. Julia, what about you? What would you invent if you could?
I would like to find a way of transporting me from one country to another really quickly and safely and reduce the travel time, because traveling in sport and being an elite athlete or support staff is exhausting. So I would like to see that just cut down to minutes, please, so that we can, you know, maximise the resources we have and get rid of that horrible jet lag.
And last question for you all, a bit of a curveball or something on the other side of the tech. Has there ever been moments in your careers when the athlete or the event didn't go the way the data predicted? Or is it generally, have you always been spot on and completely perfect? I'm sure that's the case. But have you ever been slightly off on a prediction or a analysis?
Yeah. Oh, there's so many surprises. I mean, some of the moves that we may have, you know, looked at saying, right, we're going to do this technique on that move, it's faster, and we're comparing as the guys and girls are coming down the course, and then someone just throws out an absolute blinder and you have never seen it before. And obviously, you know, you might have time to react to that, or you might just, you know, best to ignore it and actually focus on the plan ahead and then take that into the next training camp. So without a doubt, there's always surprises, because elite athletes can learn quick and do some amazing stuff.
I think what makes sport so exciting is that it is unpredictable, and no amount of data analysis beforehand is going to change that.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely why we love it and why we all keep working in it. And Matt, I know you've got a future best-selling book out right now. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, let's hope so. Yes, it's called All to Play For: How Sport Can Reboot Our Future. So it's a bit of a picture of how sport and exercise is at a tipping point of opportunity for Britain and beyond, in terms of, rather than thinking of all of us as a little island in society, for those who are already passionate, it says, well, what if sport was at the centre of the way we went through the next 15 years? What if it helped us think differently about how we plan towns now that there aren't shops right the way through the middle of them and younger generations don't necessarily want to live in them anymore? What if we thought differently about exercise so it was something that helped us with the length of the doctor queues? We thought differently about how we planned sport for kids in PE, so it was something that was, rather than PE, it was something that was fun and just woven through lessons. And what if parents got out of the way of their kids and just let them enjoy playing? And what if we stopped getting obsessed with whether something was or wasn't a sport and just recognised that the sports that make up our constituent whole, even in the Olympic and Paralympic Games, it's going to change beyond all measure with new generations coming in. So it's a bit of a love letter for sports and exercise, which is exactly what it was intended to be, and hopefully paints a bit of a picture for us for the future. So as they meant to say, it's out already, all good bookshops, la da da da. But it was a pleasure to do.
Well, maybe if we do a podcast in 10 years' time, we can see if some of those predictions come through. Thank you very, very much, all three of you, for joining me. And here's to learning more about data and human beings and sporting performance. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to keep the conversation around data going, you can get in touch with us on social media at EIS2Win. Or why not send us a message to let us know where you're enjoying the show? Just like Andrea did. She says she's been playing the podcast on her way to work and thinks the series is a great listen. That's very kind of you to say, Andrea. And if you've missed any of our episodes, they're all available for free wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up on the EIS Insider, it's the last in the series. We're diving back into the world of athlete wellbeing with more expert guests from the English Institute of Sport. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and we'll catch up soon.